Welcome back to Podcast Recovery, everyone. We are your hosts, David O.
And Eric V.
Today we are joined by our friend Christy. How are you doing today?
I'm good.
Good.
Cool.
It got hot. Weather changed too fast.
It's pretty bad.
I'm not acclimated yet.
I think we still have cold weather episodes coming up, though, so that might be a little confusing.
Do we?
Yeah.
Fantastic. Where are you from, Christy?
All over the place, but mostly Glen Burnie.
Okay. And when were you first introduced to recovery?
2004 through drug court.
Oh, nice. Mm-hmm. That's a nudge from the judge.
Yes.
Nice. And how long have you been clean?
Next month, God willing, I will have 9 years.
Splendid. Well, congratulations. And with all that out of the way, I'm going to turn it over to you. Share your story with us.
All right. Well, where to begin? So 2004, I was introduced through drug court, and actually, I was put into drug court in 2003 after a series of events. I had my first friend pass away from overdose, and then my grandfather died. And at that point, I was 20, and I was just like, fuck this. Forget these feelings. Like, these feelings are not for me, and I'm just going to do everything I can to not have to deal with them.
Yeah.
And so that was about a month later, I got arrested for the first time. 2 weeks later, I got
arrested again.
Well, the first one was a house raid.
Nice.
So it was just like a little trap house in Pasadena that only had electricity half the time and yep. all that fun stuff. So we were all there getting ready for the night, and all of a sudden, you know, somebody was at the front door. Nobody ever comes to the front door, so...
Yeah.
Yeah, next thing, we're on the floor, SWAT team, the whole nine yards.
Did you get actual handcuffs or zip ties?
Zip ties.
Okay, yeah. Zip ties fucking suck. They, like, cut into your wrist.
Yeah. Well, on the, you know, then they took us to the police station. There was probably 20 of us and about 10 girls.
Jesus.
And so they
put... Is this a clown car you got arrested in?
Yeah, they put us all into one holding cell.
Oh, no.
Yeah, for the night. So we were just like on top of it. It was, you know, fun times. So that's how I ended up in drug court.
Mm-hmm.
And then I spent the next year trying to...
Wait, you said you got arrested 2 weeks later.
Well, I got arrested. Oh, you're right. Sorry. 2 weeks later, I got pulled over in the same area by the cop who arrested me in the raid.
Nice.
So she decided to search my car.
Of course.
And I had, I was selling weed.
Mm. Yeah.
And I had all my stuff in my car, and so they found it all and took me back in again, and I got out on my own recog, and my parents got a lawyer, and the lawyer, because back then you could only go to drug court if it was your first offense. I don't know how it is now, but that's how it was then. And so my lawyer got them to, because they were so close together, look at them as one offense and got me into drug court.
Nice.
Yeah, and got the felony distribution charge dropped so that it was just misdemeanors.
That's lucky.
Yeah, lots of luck happening in this story.
Yeah,
yeah, so about, so all that happened. So the next year I spent trying to use successfully without getting caught,
mm-hmm.
you know, succeeding about half the time. I got an hour in jail, a day in jail, a weekend in jail, and then I FTA'd a court date, and they put a warrant out for me to be held without bond.
Yep.
Or bail, whatever it is. And so I got picked up on that it was a couple days after I'd gone to my parents and said, I can't keep doing this, like, I need help, because it was progressing. You know, at that point I was... doing painkillers and smoking weed and drinking, and I knew I was on the verge of graduating to the next level of things.
Yep.
So I got picked up. I got held for about 10 days, and I went in front of the drug court judge the first day, and he said, I've seen your face a lot. I think you need to sit for a little while.
Nice.
And I was like, all right. And then when I went back about 10 days later, he was on vacation, and there was a female judge who didn't know me.
Ooh.
Who
Couldn't
said.
Be good or bad.
Yeah, so she let me out, but I had to do a urinalysis every day. I had to go to intensive outpatient. I had to go to see a psychiatrist, and I wasn't allowed to work, and I had to live with my parents until they found an inpatient facility for me to go to. So that was, I don't know, that was like the spring of 04. And I got into a place in Virginia in July of 04. So actually the date that they were letting me go to the rehab was this anniversary of my friend who had passed away, his death. So I took it as like a sign that like that was where I was supposed to go. So I went down there, and that's where they introduced me to the program. And, you know, they taught me everything I needed to do, you know, be honest, open-minded and willing, go to meetings, get a sponsor, you know, change people, places, and things. Yep. And I wasn't willing to do any of that.
No, of course not.
But I decided in my brilliant thinking that if I just lived in Virginia, that that would solve my problems because I don't know where to get high in Virginia. Right. I know, it's great now. So the judge of drug court let me move. He said that I just had to drive home once a month and check in with him and then finish out drug court that way. And so I made it 89 days before I came home to get some of my stuff and relapsed or got high, really. And then, and that was the next 2 years, you know, 30, 60 days, get high, you know, not really doing anything different, not going to meetings. I went to meetings. That's one thing I've always done. I went to meetings. I didn't have anywhere else to go. Like, it was the only place that, you know, there was nothing else. I wasn't talking to my family. I didn't have any friends.
Were you at least, like, honest about your using in meetings, or were you, like, totally failing?
Eventually. I mean, I would go to meetings high and be like, no, of course I'm clean. What do you mean? But then a week later, I'd be like, yeah, I was totally high.
Dude, you smell like Kush. We know you're not.
My favorite story is I went to the first time I ever went to the Free State Convention in Baltimore. I was living in Virginia. I came up with Virginia people to go. I left the Virginia people, went and got high with old people, came back to the convention and was like, hey, I'm good. Everything's great. I didn't just snort any oxys. No, I'm totally fine. And I was convinced I was pulling it off, of course. Yeah, of course I wasn't. So let's see. 05 was when I moved back to Maryland. So it was, I think, about March, and it was March, actually, and I had relapsed. I had gone back to the treatment center again. I'd gone through their program again. I got out. I had met some people, and I got high with them and moved up to the, you know, heroin and cocaine. And that was about 2 weeks run with them before my mom called and said the judge was looking for me. And said that I needed to come home. And then she called again the next day and asked me if I wanted to come home. And, like, for me, that was a huge turning point because while I was talking to her, I was just thinking, tell her you need to come home. Tell her you need to come home. Like, the people that I was with and the stuff that was happening was getting really bad, really fast. And I couldn't bring myself to say it. And then she said, do you need me to come get you now? And I said, yes. And so my dad was there that night to get me and bring me back to Maryland. And, yeah, they let me come home again for
Where in Virginia were you?
Winchester.
Oh, okay. So not that far.
No, it was about 2 hours from here. Not too bad. And they had – Winchester was really cool back then because they had one meeting a night a week and you walked to it. And everything was, like, in the same little area and – everybody knew everybody, and my first sponsor had 9 months clean because that was a lot of clean time.
Yeah, that's what you got in Winchester.
Yeah. So when I came to Maryland and started going to meetings, and the first meeting I went to, they said, if you have, you know, I think it was 5 years or something, raise your hand. And, like, all these women raised their hands, and I was like, whoa, what is happening? This is crazy. So, yeah, so I spent the next year doing the same thing, 30, 60, 90, in and out. But each time I would come back, I would do a little more. So I got a sponsor, I got a service commitment, I got a home group. And then by March of 06, I was pretty involved, but I still wasn't being honest. I still wasn't willing or able to tell people what was really going on with me. So I woke up one day, it was St. Patrick's Day, and it was a nice day. It was like 70 degrees out, and I had been saving money to get my car back. I needed insurance and tags and whatever. Mm-hmm. And I was like, all right, it's a really nice day to get high, so why not? Yeah. And, you know, I had the voices in my head, call your sponsor, go to a meeting, do all the things. Mm-hmm. And I was like, no, no, you can just go away. Yep. I'm not doing that. So that's what I did. So I went out and I spent, I had, I don't know, somewhere between $300 to $500 in my account, and I spent it all with the hope that I wasn't going to wake up the next day. At that point, you know, mm-hmm. I just really believed that I was special and that I was worse off than everybody else, and that if you could get in my head and hear what was going on, you would tell me, like, please keep getting high. You deserve it. Oof. And so, yeah, so the best thing I could hope for at that point in my life was that I just wouldn't wake up the next day. Mm-hmm. And so I did, in my sponsor's house.
What?
Yeah, so apparently in my grand, I guess they had been looking for me because I wasn't where I was supposed to be. Because I left work at lunch and never came back. So that worried everybody. Yeah.
That's a good tip.
Yeah, usually. There was, yeah. So I ended up in my sponsor's house. I woke up the next morning and I was like, okay, I'm done. I'll do what you say. I'll write the steps. I'll do all the things. I, you know, clearly my way is not working. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then that, and that's what I did for the next 2.5 years. I worked steps. I was in service. I got better. I started learning how to be honest. I called my sponsor every day, said, I want to get high. I want to get high every single day. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there's so many directions it could go at this point. So I, at 6 months clean, I got pregnant with my daughter. Mm-hmm. You know, I never stayed out of relationships. Men were a way to find connection, and sex was a way to connect. And I didn't, and I only know this now because I've done step work and looking back, yeah. I had no clue at the time what was happening. Yeah. But now I know, like, I was just looking for love and mm-hmm. acceptance and connection. And so I got pregnant with my daughter at 6 months. And then at 2.5 years clean, my best friend, who we had, our clean dates were about a month apart, and mm-hmm. we did everything together, got clean together, the whole nine yards, we're inseparable, and she got high. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I didn't realize then was that I had decided that I could stay clean as long as she stayed clean.
Ooh.
So when she got high, I was devastated. I was just destroyed. And so I decided at that point that I would, I wasn't going to feel my feelings because I think I had worked one or two steps at that point, but I was not applying them in my life. I was very begrudgingly writing them. Mm-hmm. And so I decided I wasn't going to feel my feelings, but I also wasn't going to get high because I wanted to be here when she got back. So I spent the next year and a half doing all the things, lying, cheating, stealing, gambling, mm-hmm. sleeping with everyone, sleeping with your boyfriend, having, you know, my daughter's father and I were on and off through that whole time, and was just a disaster, you know. And so I celebrated 4 years clean. My best friend was clean at that point. It was March. She had gotten clean in September. And I celebrated 4 years clean, and I wanted to die. Mm-hmm. And I got up there, and I shared all the good stuff, and I said all the things I thought I was supposed to say, and I didn't tell anyone that I was planning my suicide, really. And so that was March. So April, I decided I was going to do it. I was going to kill myself. Ooh. And because at that point, I was so, like, the corner, you know, they talk about the corner. You back yourself into the corner, you can't get out of clean. Mm-hmm. And I never understood that for a really long time until I was there, yep. you know? And the reality is that I could have gotten honest and told everyone what was going on and gotten help. Mm-hmm. But I was so far removed at that point from honesty that I couldn't do it. I wasn't willing to do it.
Yeah.
And so I decided my daughter was better off without me, and I made the plan, and I knew exactly how I was going to do it that night. And so, in some weird, twisted thing, I decided I wanted to say goodbye to N.A. Oh, whatever.
That's yeah, okay.
I made it so far.
It happens.
And so I decided to go to a meeting that I knew none of my network went to. Nobody I knew went to that meeting. It was a very small meeting. and that I was just going to go and that would be like my goodbye and then I would go carry out my plan. And I show up to the meeting and my best friend's there and the guy that I'm sleeping with is there and another person I know is there and they all know that I'm not okay. They can just see it in my eye. I don't hide things well. And so, you know, I didn't tell them what I was planning or what was going on, but I did tell them that I wasn't okay. And so they decided to babysit me and keep me for the night and help me get to a doctor the next day. So I did that and I got put on medication and, you know, but I kept doing all the things. I kept all the lying, the stealing, all the stuff I was doing. And so in the following month in May, I finally was like, well, you know, everything else hasn't worked. So now it's just time to get high. You know, in my brain, that was all that was left to do. So I did. And I went out and I got high for about a week. And I went, you know, right back to where I picked up intentionally. I was like, I knew drinking wasn't the answer. I knew just doing one thing or another wasn't the answer. So I just went back to where I left off. And I took, you know, I had my daughter with me. I was getting high with her with me. And, you know, all the things that I said I would never do and all the things that I said I was grateful that she would have an opportunity to not see me high went right out the window. And so after about a week, it was her birthday. It was her third birthday. And I knew I'd gone to my friend's anniversary. I think it was the night before, either one of the nights right before her birthday. I went to one of my best friend's anniversary and my sponsor was there. And I mean, I knew everybody there and I was high as gas and they all, I mean, I was supposed to go to dinner.
High as gas. I've never heard that one before. That's like pretty good. Yeah. I've heard a whole bunch of different analogies, but that's
really awesome. First.
I'm going to steal that. Keep going. Sorry.
No, you're fine. So I was supposed to go to dinner. I couldn't get out of the bathroom to get to dinner. So I did make it to the meeting. And this guy came in late, was planning on darting out as soon as it was over. And before I could get out, this guy that I'd known for years came up to me and said, you know, if you ever need anything, I'm here. And I was like, oh, yeah, man, I'm good. I'm good. And I like ran away. And so that, you know, her birthday was either a day or two later and I woke up and I was like, man, at this point, it's only a matter of time. Like once my parents find out, they're going to take my kid and that's it. And I'm either going to be gone or, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. So I called her dad and my best friend and I told them, what I was doing and they got rid of all the stuff and they drugged me to a meeting and made me pick up a one day and do all the things. And I was just like, I was just angry and just all the things. But I knew that I didn't want to drag my daughter through what I knew was coming. I knew what was coming was going to be ugly and bad, and I just didn't want her to have to go through it. So I decided to give it a try for her and see if I could, you know, do it for her for a while. And yeah, so that's what I did. So when I had about somewhere between 4 months and 6 months, I went to an anniversary, and the girl who was celebrating said that she had had 4 years clean, she had relapsed, and when she got clean again, she got clean for her husband, not because she actually wanted to be clean. And she was there celebrating 4 years again. And it was just like the shot of hope that I needed, that like maybe if I could just hold on a little longer, I might actually want to be clean for myself again. And I knew the other thing that I knew without a shadow of a doubt was that I was the problem. Like I needed to do the work. As soon as I got my feet stable again, I called my sponsor. I'm like, I need to do step work. I need to do all the step work because I just knew that I was the problem. There was no more denying it. I needed to change. I needed to be a different person. And she was like, you need to settle down and learn how to be honest again. I was like, that's valid. All right. So I started over and I started being honest again. I started being open-minded, willing. I cut out all the behaviors that I had been doing, cut off all the people. You know, I mean, at that point, I had a network when I relapsed, but my whole network, except my sponsor, was just co-signing all the crap I was doing. So I had to change everything again. And, that was June of 2010. And my life is just beyond my wildest dreams. And I just, you know, it's such a cliche. And I always say I hate saying it, but I always say it because I don't know of any other way to explain it.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to fast forward. So I went back to school. I got my associate's degree. I just graduated last year. I own a home now. I have a job I love. You know, my daughter is a great kid and wonderful and hopefully will not remember that brief blip in her life. And, you know, I'm in a healthy, stable relationship now, which is just crazy to me sometimes still because...
Oh, yeah.
That
freaks me out more than probably it should because I should be used to it after like 4 years. But I'm just like, every once in a while, it's just like, how the hell did I get here?
Yeah.
Like...
Yeah, I mean, it's so crazy. When I look back, even like when I look back to who I was when I like was using before I even knew about the program, and then even looking back to who I was when I relapsed, like I barely know that person anymore. It's just so different. So different. So, you know, the first 5 years were just normal life stuff. You know, I accumulated some things. My mom had cancer. My daughter's grandfather had cancer. Her great-grandmother had cancer. Like, life showed up. It was definitely not all roses by any means. I learned coping skills. I learned how to deal with feelings and feel feelings and live life in right steps and get better. And then, so 2015, I celebrated 5 years clean, and I was over the moon happy. Because, you know, my disease always told me, you got four, but you'll never get more than four. Like, you will screw this up, because that's what you do. You screw things up.
Oh, yeah.
And so I celebrated 5 years clean, and I was just like, yeah, I was just over the moon. And it was, you know, a high of all highs. And... 3 weeks later, one of my best friends, who was like a brother to me, he had had like 5 years clean, got his heart broken, didn't want to deal with the feelings, relapsed, and, 3 weeks after my 5 year anniversary, he overdosed. Oof. So, you know, when I went to rehab, the first prayer that I ever prayed was like, God, if you want me to stay clean, don't let anyone close to me die. 'Cause I will not stay clean through it. I won't.
Oh yeah.
So I'd lost people before him, but he was the first, like, in my inner circle. You know, when I relapsed, like, he was the one that took me to the meetings. He was the one that I called and said I got high, and he said, all right, let's go to a meeting. Like, there was no anything about it. And, I mean, losing him was still one of the hardest things that I've been through. And the next, like, I mean, 9 months to a year, just a blur. I mean, I went to a convention that August, which was only about 2 months later. I don't remember any of it. I see pictures. I know I was there, but I was just in such a fog of grief. And, you know, and I knew that that was the sort of thing that would take me out, could have the possibility to take me out. So I was, like, super vigilant. Like, I need to go to meetings. I need to stay on my recovery. If I do nothing else right, I have to stay clean through this. And then, you know, and that's really all I was capable of doing at that time was just staying clean. And I was on my 10th step. And so December comes around and my sponsee was on her 9th step. And I was like, oh boy, like this is going to be a thing. So I call my sponsor and I'm like, you know, my sponsee's on her 9th step. I'm going to have to tell her to get a new sponsor. Like she's going to be on 10 soon. And my sponsor says, or you could just finish your 10th step. And I was like, oh, well, there's an idea.
there's an option.
Right. So simple. And so, yeah. So that's what I did. So I finished my 10th step and got back into the step work and started to find some recovery again. And a lot happened around that time. You know, I had gone back to school and... I had like this idea of this dream job that I wanted when I was finished school. And I saw it about a year left at that point or more. And somebody just like handed me my dream job on a platter. It was like, do you want this? And I was like, is this real life? Are you serious? And then March of 2016, we bought our house. And, you know, when I was growing up, I mean, I never even dreamed of owning a home. Even when my fiance started saying, you know, maybe we should look into buying a house. I was like, why? Why don't we just keep renting? I mean, that's crazy. It just never even was like a thing in my brain. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, all of a sudden I'm like, I'm buying a house and I'm, you know, and there were a lot of good things that happened, but I was definitely still very much in this grief. And so I finished 10, 11, and 12, and they were really just life-changing steps for me, mm-hmm. you know, like the trying to start a regular meditation practice and trying to, like, mm-hmm. so up until that point, I had always said, I don't care about the higher power thing. I know I have one. I will pray to it when I remember, which mm-hmm. wasn't very often. And I didn't need to know what it was. I didn't need a religion. I just didn't need any of that stuff. And then when I got to 11 and 12, I started to wonder, like, you know, maybe there's something more. Maybe, mm-hmm. and I just started exploring things and I started looking into things that felt, you know, I'm still not a religious person, but just practices, spiritual practices that like felt right to me. And in doing that, I found some practices that worked for me, and I found my people, or whatever. I don't even know what you would
found
call it.
Found your tribe.
Yeah, I try not. Yeah. I read a thing about saying tribe and how it's not okay.
Cultural appropriation.
Yeah,
okay,
whatever.
Apologies, everybody out there. I'm sorry. You found your niche.
Yeah. So I started exploring. So
now I feel like a dick.
You're not. I'm sorry. we're all learning every day. You learned a new thing. That's it. We're all learning. So 2016.
All the cool kids were saying it. I just wanted to be cool.
I know. I was going to get it tattooed on me.
Shut up.
I swear to God.
Oh. We both dodged a bullet.
We did. So 2016, I started to have these realizations. And I had worked all 12 steps. And I just started to realize. I started to take a look at my life and realize that I had no idea. The people around me that I spent all my time with, or not all, but some of the people that I was spending time with, it was like we didn't have a lot in common. Mm-hmm. And so I started to wonder, like, why is that? Like, what's happening? And I started really taking a look at stuff, and I just realized that I wasn't being my true self. Mm-hmm. I was just being the person I thought you wanted me to be so that you would be my friend, because I still didn't think that I was worthy of love. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and all that, I mean, this has been like a 2-3 year process of stuff that I've realized now. But yeah. And so I just started to realize, you know, I'm not being my true self. And like, it was this whole, I call 2018 the great unraveling, because it was a whole year of just me having.
That's a great name for a book.
Yeah.
The Great Unraveling. That's good.
You can have it.
Stolen. Yoink.
Yeah. So I just started to have all these realizations about myself and my life and mm-hmm. like, you know, my childhood. And, you know, I wrote all 12 steps, but like, I focus on my time clean before and my relapse and, like, you know, little bits and pieces here and there. And one of the things that I've realized is that I, you know, if something happens that I don't like, I make it pretty. So, like, things that happened in my childhood, I change the story in my head to make it less traumatic or sad or scary or whatever the situation was. I made it pretty. And so when I wrote my first round of steps, I was writing on the stories I had created. I wasn't writing on what actually happened.
Wow.
And so now I'm about to start my fourth step again, and I'm realizing that, you know, my childhood was pretty freaking traumatic. Mm-hmm. And it's taken me a very long time to be able to admit that and take an honest look at it.
Yeah.
And sometimes I want to, like, beat myself up about it and be like, you should have, blah, whatever. And, but the reality is if I had seen this when I got clean 9 years ago, I wouldn't have been able to handle it. I didn't have the tools. I wouldn't have been able to do anything with it. And so, yeah, so I, 2018, I found Brené Brown. If you don't know who she is, look her up. She's amazing. And she has a TED Talk about vulnerability. And I realized that I was terrified of vulnerability. Like, to my core, it was my worst fear. Mm-hmm. And that I was going to have to figure out how to do it. If I wanted to have the life that I wanted to have and have the... It was really about relationships. My friendships, you know, my friends felt connected to me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I mean, I love them and they love me. But I didn't feel deeply connected to them because I was hiding so much. But I didn't realize I was hiding all this stuff because I was also hiding it from myself.
Wow.
And yeah, so it was quite a year. And yeah, so now 2019 started and now I am trying to put these things into practice and I'm trying to be my true self to the best of my ability and continue to grow and get better. And you know, I'm getting married this year, which is...
Me too.
Yeah,
high same five.
Yeah, so it's just, I have this amazingly wonderful life and I am, for the first time in my recovery, I'm looking forward to the growth that's going to come from this round of steps and being able to like actually have some idea of who I really am and how I work and be able to continue to grow and get better. And, you know, that used to scare the shit out of me. Steps used to just, like, terrify me to my core. My first four step, I was, like, dying. I did not want to feel any of those things. And now, I still don't want to feel them, but I know that I'm going to have growth and, you know, I'm going to understand and know myself better. And that's really what I've been trying to do for the last couple of years. And I think I'll always be trying to do, and I'll always change, and it'll be a process. I'm just really ready to, like, get rid of this childhood stuff. Be done with it and actually, like...
Oh, yeah.
You know, one of the things that it brought up is, like, my wedding. My biological father's coming, and... Because I invited him. And I haven't seen him in... I don't even know, 6-7 years, something like that. And hadn't talked to him in probably 2 or 3. Mm-hmm. And I randomly said, hey, what's your address? Because I knew he would be offended if I didn't invite him. And I'm still very much a people pleaser in some things. And since I did that, he texts me like 4 to 5 times a week. Good morning. I love you. Have a great day.
Mm-hmm.
It's very strange. Mm-hmm. But... You know, it's just things like that that, you know, coming up in my life, and I'm like, man, I still have some feelings and with some things that I need to take a look at and deal with. Right. So, yeah, I mean, that's where I am today. There's always more I could say, but I feel like I'm going to start rambling.
No, that was great.
That was fantastic. I'm going to start, Eric. I'm not even going to ask.
It's fine. Do what you want to do.
I'm going to start light. Mm. I saw your Jack Skellington tattoo.
Yes.
Now, is Nightmare Before Christmas, is that a Halloween movie or a Christmas movie? You have to pick one.
I have to pick one because I watch them both. I watch it at Halloween and at Christmas.
I do too. But I have strong feelings about this.
I would say Halloween.
You think it's a Halloween movie?
I would, yeah.
What about you, Eric?
Oh, Christmas.
I think it's Christmas.
It's easily a Christmas movie.
Yeah.
See, it's the setting is Halloween, but the plot is all Christmas driven.
That's a valid point. Yeah. Here's the other thing, too, though. I just don't have that many Halloween movies to watch.
Hocus Pocus.
What are you talking about?
Well, I watch that one all the
time,
of course.
But that's really...
But I have, like a million.
Dude, Charlie Brown.
Dude, so many horror movies.
I wasn't thinking horror. I was thinking Halloween plot.
Yeah, you have Hocus Pocus.
But there is the Halloween movies, which are my favorite.
Charlie Brown has a good Halloween movie as well.
Yeah.
The Pumpkin's good.
Is it Pigpen who gets The Rock?
I don't remember. I just remember the pumpkin.
I think it is. The Great Pumpkin?
Yeah. Trick or Treat is actually a good Halloween themed anthology movie. That one's pretty good.
I haven't seen that one.
That's pretty good. Cool. Also like American Horror Story episodes. If you just went off like episodes, episodes.
We opened a box.
We need to close this
immediately.
I mean, I could keep talking about this, you know.
I know. I kiboshed that. All right. All right. What are the feelings about going to like multiple rehab stints at the same place?
You know, it was kind of cool, actually.
You're going to answer this too, Eric.
It was kind of cool because...
Go ahead.
Sorry. You're okay. The place that I went back the second time, there was a lot of young kids there, younger than me. I was only 22 at the time, but there was like a lot of 18, 19 year olds there. Mm-hmm. So they kind of made me like a big sister kind of person, and I got to like help the younger kids.
And you were like, oh, I've been here before.
I'm like, yeah, man, I got this. I can show you the ropes. And then also there was another guy from Baltimore who ended up there the second time with me. So mm-hmm. we like became like good friends and cheating, playing spades, killing everybody. Course. And it actually was kind of awesome.
Was there like any like guilt or shame? Like, okay, I'm back in the same place and like the same people work here. They're seeing my face again.
Not with the people that work there. I mean, they were watching me get high. So I'd much rather have them see me there than what I was doing before I got back there. I was grateful, honestly, because they didn't have to take me back. I didn't pay anything the second time I went.
Oh.
They worked it out through some funding thing to, like, get me in.
Scholarship,
yeah. Nice. And I wasn't technically a Virginia resident, so they really shouldn't have been able to do that. Oh. And they, like, pulled strings and... So I was just really grateful to, like, be somewhere safe.
Nice.
I'm sure there was some shame in this. There was shame going and asking them, could they help me?
Yeah.
But then once they did, I was just, like, glad to be not getting high at that moment.
All right. Over to you, Eric.
What? Yeah. I've never been inpatient. I've never been to the same treatment center.
Really?
I mean, yeah. IOPs and outpatient. Yeah, of course. Been, like, you know, it's just a rotating door. But, yeah, inpatient was different every single time.
Huh. Mm-hmm. I thought you had been to the same place multiple times.
Oh, well. No, I like to just go around, you know.
All right, to your questions. Well,
From what I hear, the place that I ended up in was one of the better ones, so I'm kind of glad that I just stuck with that little place.
Oh,
we were allowed to wear tank tops and walk to meetings. And
oh, wow.
They made us breakfast we could order our breakfast every morning, and they made it for us.
That's nice.
It was super awesome.
Nice.
So... relapse question, I guess. I'm a relapser, so I can relate. And I guess one of the things I realized that was difficult with relapsing is like coming back into the rooms and just like the judgment. And even if there isn't judgment, there's perceived judgment, but there probably is judgment as well, because just naturally judgment.
Yeah.
So I guess how hard was it for you to like face the humility and, you know, come back to recovery?
I mean, it was super hard because not only had I relapsed, but I had been like lying to everybody and like screwing my closest friends over for at least a year up to that point. So, I mean, they were all very hurt and very upset, and rightfully so, you know what I mean? And so I definitely felt a lot of judgment and was very, you know, like I said, I just didn't want to be there. But I also, I think having my daughter helped, because I knew what her life would be if I didn't figure out a way to get clean. And, you know, that guy that passed away, he drugged me to meetings when I didn't want to go. He literally would just, he didn't have a car, so he would just call and be like, hey, you got to take me to a meeting tonight. And so my people pleasing and my, you know, wanting to help others would be like, oh, well, I mean, he's got to get to a meeting and I'm so important and whatever. So, I mean, it was more hard when it came to sharing about how I was feeling or what was going on. I was very limited who I would talk honestly with about what was really going on with me. So I didn't share in meetings. I didn't, you know, I didn't talk to random people. I had a very small network of people that I knew and trusted. And probably the first year, I really didn't go outside of them much because of, you know, just convinced everyone hated me and thought I was horrible and all that stuff.
Oh, that, yeah, that good stuff.
Yeah, because I'm so important.
All right. I'm going to piggyback off of Eric a little bit. Describe what it's like getting, because we've heard this, like, another cliche, getting high with a head full of recovery. Describe that to us.
Oh, man. So, I mean, it's literally like a switch just turns on and it's just nonstop NA cliches the whole time. Like, you, at least in my experience, I could not get high enough to make the NA shut up. And it would just be like, You should have called your sponsor. You should have gone to a meeting. Oh, you've done it now. See, I told you, you're a terrible person. You never do any, you know, you can't do anything right. You're always going to be this piece of shit. So you might as well just kill your, I mean, nonstop, just, you know, beating myself up along with the, oh, you should have gone to a meeting. You should have all the things. Yeah. I mean, it's just like, if you've ever obsessed on something, it's that times 10, just nonstop. The whole time.
All right.
With occasional thoughts of, where am I going to get my next one?
Yeah.
What's happening with that?
Yeah. All right. What else you got, Eric?
I just thought of this one.
Ooh.
It's a two-part question. Okay. So you were talking about step four. So I figured this is a good step four question. What would you consider your strongest asset? And then conversely, what defect would you like to have removed most?
Well, the defect one's the easier one, so I'm going to answer that one first. So it's the one that I've seen most recently become aware of, which is my jealousy. So I have this belief that, like, there's a limited amount of good things in the world, and that if somebody else gets it, that means I can't. And so... Yeah, so I have this belief that, like, there's a limited supply of happy or good things. I don't know why. I haven't gotten there yet. But for some reason, this is what I believe. So when, like, somebody, even when it's somebody I love and care about, I can fake, like, being happy. But inside, I'm like, so the best example I have of this is my friend and I, about 5 years ago, started going to the gym together. And she really enjoyed it and really liked it and really wanted me to keep going with her. But for some reason... it made her so happy and she liked it so much that I stopped going.
Because she was happy?
I don't know. I really don't. It's so weird. It's like I get jealous that, like, I think it was her willingness, her like ability to like be willing. I mean, it's crazy. I know. Yeah.
Wait.
It's so
you're
weird.
Liking this too much.
So,
I can't.
So you two are both getting married this year.
Yeah.
So is his wedding going to adversely affect your wedding?
No, because I'm working on it. It's gotten much better since then.
But
that was
theoretically,
like
that would be the,
well, but
the
we're not,
theory.
So there's,
I mean,
only so
the
many
theory,
weddings
yeah.
in
There's only
one
so
year.
Many happy weddings that can happen, guys. I hate to bring it to you.
Oh, God.
That's kind of a, like...
Oh, it's God. Insane.
Yeah.
It's literally insane, yeah. No, I know, and I've only realized it
I
last
just took
year.
All the wind out of my sails. Holy shit, that scared the shit out of me. I was like, oh, my God.
Well, so here's the thing,
well,
right?
Well, she is
so,
the happy wedding.
Let's connect it back, right? So, Brené Brown... says that the most vulnerable feeling you can have is joy, because when it's taken away from you, or if it's taken away from you, that feeling is terrible. So most people have the hardest time allowing themselves to feel joy. So if I allow myself to enjoy something, it's a very vulnerable feeling, and I don't do vulnerability. So I constantly make myself miserable for fear of losing the joy.
Just go straight line, content. Wow. Just go content. Don't go into joy.
You know, and
don't go into misery. Just go.
Right, but here's the thing: like joy and misery.
Jesus,
happen.
That's horrible, Eric. That's
it's not. It's
let's
not.
Just stay gray. You know, no really that's, rainy days or super sunny days. Just that mild gray haze. Let's
that's
just
my,
stay.
That's my theory,
dude. Well, that's look, just literally living in purgatory. That sucks ass.
I mean, I don't necessarily think it's completely wrong.
It's better than the like you know the depression,
God.
Like, right?
God, you're
and
cynical.
You have choices.
God, you're
and you
cynical.
You have choices, David. You want to choose, like, you do you want to choose, like, terrible depression, or do you want to choose just, like, straight line?
Dude.
Well, and here's, so yeah. Here's the thing that I think.
I like the roller coaster. I like crying, okay?
I know that.
I like the roller coaster, but I think now, and this is all a work in progress, so I could change my mind a year from now, but right now what I think is that I think aiming for the content is where I need to aim and allow the bad and good to happen on its own.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I don't Absolutely. Make the bad and good things happen. Mm-hmm. I just try to be in the content, and then when the good and bad things happen, I enjoy the good, and I deal with the bad.
You feel yeah. those feelings.
Try. Yes. Mm-hmm. That's the goal, and I'm still learning. So, yeah. So, it's crazy. So, the jealousy, I need it to go away.
Okay.
It's insane. Mm-hmm.
And what's your asset?
Oh, gosh. All right. So, my asset. I definitely am very... I really want to help people in a... So I really want to be able to help people, and I really want to be able to do what I can to help others have the best life that they can. And I have always tried to do that in my life, but what I'm realizing now is that, you know, I had taken that asset too far, and I was trying to force my will onto people because I thought that it would help them. Mm-hmm. And so now I am trying to be helpful when the opportunity presents itself to people who actually want help, instead of being like, hey, I love you and I can, you know, that's what happened with my best friend when we got clean the first time. I thought that I could help her, and it was a very arrogant, like, thing. And it can be a very arrogant thing if it's taken to this level.
Oh, yeah.
Where I'm like, oh, I have all the answers and I can fix everything. Mm-hmm. And really, it, what I'm realizing now is that it was, I thought it was the only way I could be worthy of love and acceptance is if I was helping people. And if I wasn't helping people, then I wasn't worth anything. And so I would force my help onto people who didn't really, who I probably wasn't even qualified to help, plus didn't want my help. So now, you know, I'm just trying to make myself available in the ways that come naturally and when people ask. But I really do love helping people.
Cool.
Absolutely. All right. You talked about after you lost your friend, how, like, for a good amount of time you were in, like, a fog and all you could focus on was, like, just staying clean. And I think we kind of overlook the importance of that, like, that simplicity in recovery. Because, like, we want things. We want a job. We want a relationship. We want this. We want that. And we want these big leaps and strides forward in our life. But how important is it to really look at just that small fact of just staying clean is monumental?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. For me at that point in time, it was a freaking miracle because I still, I mean, I had 5 years clean at that point and I still didn't know if I could actually stay clean if somebody that close to me died.
Yeah.
And so, logically, I knew it was possible, but like mentally and emotionally, I didn't know that I was capable of it. And so that was really a time that I really allowed myself to just, and the other thing too, is I didn't want to carry that death for the rest of my life. So I really wanted to grieve. So I would just say to myself, like, if you're sad, just be sad. And I was sad for a long time. And I would get offended. People would be like, what's wrong? I'd be like, hello, my friend died. And it would be like 4 months later. Like, of course they're not still thinking about it because, but I whatever. So yeah, I just let myself feel my feelings and told myself that I just needed to stay clean. And I really, it was the first time in my recovery that I really allowed myself that luxury of just like not trying to force myself to be more than I was at that moment. And I think that's really what like kickstarted, you know, the later epiphanies where when I got to, you know, realizing that I just had no clue who I was.
Yeah.
Right. Did that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. What you got, Eric?
What does recovery mean to you?
I knew it. Fucking knew it. I was going to steal it from you today.
I know. That's why I did it right now.
I was totally going to steal it.
I know.
I was just, damn it.
These questions, like, in the step work one, it'll say, like, what does blank mean to you? I, in my first round, when I had my first few years clean, I would write, this is a stupid goddamn question, and I hate it, and I don't want to answer it, because it would just make me so angry. And now I really try to, like, think about it and have an answer. So, I mean, I think recovery for me is just being, I always say honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness is the most important thing. I can't have recovery if I don't have those. And as long as I am, you know, as long as I have that, then I can grow and continue to get better every day. And I think that's just what recovery is for me, is just growing and continuing to get better and just trying to be the best me that I can be.
All
right, cool. Love it. All right. one of like the biggest things like I got from your story was just like absolute dedication. Like even when like you knew you were getting like you were getting high, like you were just still just sort of trying to put puzzle pieces where they needed to go in your life. So and then you talked about it like dedication to your step work and just keep having to do something, like even just a half a step forward. So how important is dedication to your own recovery?
I don't know that I've ever looked at it that way. I mean, I think it's super important, especially, I think the difference between my recovery now and my recovery when I had 4 years clean, part of what made it easy, not easy, but part of what made the decision to relapse a little easier was the fact that I really hadn't gained much inside. I had some like outside stuff, but it was like stuff that I was like, I mean, I can get it back because I had lost it and gotten those things back so many times before. And so like this time I've really done the work to like take a look at myself and get better and grow and be different. And now I always say like, I would not want to start, you know, I used to say, oh, starting over, whatever, no big deal. And now I'm like, I don't want to start this over again. So I think that is part of where the dedication comes from, is that like, I've gained so much, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, that the thought of having to do it, the work again to get all this back is just like, no, I will just do the work that needs to be done to keep it so that I don't have to go through all that again to get back here. Because it's been a lot of work.
Yeah.
A lot of feelings. Yeah, hell stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, recovery's fucking work.
It is.
How many more questions do you have, Eric? I have three.
Three?
Yeah. I'm loving this.
Trim that down.
I'll trim it down. I trimmed it down to three. That is my trimmings.
I can do two, I guess.
Okay. One. Yeah, okay. Cool.
Two, three. So.
Cool. So I get to go again. How important had like how important for you, and like I also want you to answer for like, I don't know, like a broad general sense. So like, how important has finding a spirituality that worked for you, and what do you think the role in spirituality is in recovery in general?
I mean, I think for me it's super important. It's been life-changing. You know, before I really started digging into like figuring out a spiritual practice that worked for me, I mean, I would pray here and there, and you know, I had a lot of really good stuff in my life, but when I really started to focus on the spiritual side of my program is really when the growth really just exploded. And it was like, I mean, it is not a coincidence that it directly coincided with 2018, where, you know, I suddenly was having all these realizations about myself and seeing my life clearer was directly connected to the fact that I was meditating regularly, I was praying, I was developing a relationship with my higher power that was more than just, hey, help get me out of this, or you know this person's going through this, please help them. It was a, you know, more daily practice, and it gave me the strength and tools that I needed to be able to really dive deeper into myself and start to become aware of. And you know, one of the things I didn't talk about, and this is really was another huge turning point towards my spiritual growth, was that my significant other, it has PTSD and was hospitalized at the end of 2017. And so when that happened, I took it as a failure on my part that I couldn't save her, I couldn't help her, I couldn't you know, because like I said, I was always trying to help people because that's where my worth came from. And I couldn't help her, so clearly I wasn't worth anything. And it was just like a very not good spiral for me after that. But it led to me realizing that, you know, I can't, saving people is not my job. And that I, you know, do have worth even, you know, it's just not my job. And I just, you know, and I just really, I didn't realize how connected my self-worth was to me feeling like I am able to save people. Really, same thing happened with my best friend. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
When she got high, I didn't save her. So I was not worthy anymore. Mm. And yeah, so if I hadn't been willing at that moment to dive, because my defects came roaring back, mm-hmm. like, and I, thank God, had a program and the willingness to, like, talk to people and ask for help and, you know, dive into the spiritual side of things to get the help that I needed. Because if that had happened, you know, even a few years before, I would have ran from the feelings. I wouldn't have been willing or able or had the tools to, like, deal with them and show up. So for the, like, for everyone as a whole, I think that it's super important, but I also think it's super personal. You know what I mean? And I think that I do think that it could be talked about a little more, but I think a lot of people don't know how to talk about it, like, in the way that I think it should be talked about. And, you know, I don't think that any, I mean, I just think that it's a whole other level of recovery that everybody deserves to get to when they're ready to get to it. And, you know, it's literally changed my life more than I could even describe.
Nice. All right.
Thanks.
Absolutely perfect.
Cool. How has addiction manifested itself in your life this go-around?
You son of a bitch.
They're all my, all these stock questions are mine.
Don't take,
so that's fine.
You're a jerk.
But how, not the time when you're
cheating. We're
going
cheating to couples therapy,
Eric. And you're lying. Not the cheating and lying this time.
Yeah. So when I got clean this time, I'd really hit a bottom with sex. So I was done. That was not even an option. And so this time it's been food. I would say is number one, food. Shopping, money. I don't really gamble. I dabbled with it here and there, but it was never really my thing. I would say the top two would be shopping, spending money in any form, including spending money on travel and food, man. I really like when
I love food.
And I'm a pastry chef, so it's just I tell people I set myself up for failure. Yeah. I just like
when life gives you when life gives you lemons, make meringue pie.
Exactly. Yeah. So I yeah, I mean, I have, you know, I had my daughter and I was super like rail thin before I had her and I had her and the relationship I was in was not good and food comforted me and I didn't see it at that time. I didn't see it till very recently. And so I ran with that and then I would have periods of, you know, just being better with it or I don't even know what to call it, but there were periods where it wasn't always out of control, but it really has gotten out of control the last few years. And then in the beginning of 2018, I was diagnosed pre-diabetic. And so, yeah, and I was 35. So I was devastated. I was just like devastated. And diabetes runs in my family. I always knew that it was a risk and it like everybody in my family has it. And, so when I was diagnosed, I was like, I mean, I have to do something. My grandfather, his death was a direct result of diabetes. My brother, you know, is in horrible condition as a direct result, half at least from diabetes. And I was just like, you know, this isn't like fun and games anymore. It's not, oh, a couple potato chips, a cake here and there. Not a big deal. Like now it's real life. So I started, you know, I've been trying like fad diets and different things like that since I turned 30. I turned 30 and I was like, I don't want to be 30 and, you know.
I don't want to be 30, period.
Well, that was definitely part of it. But, you know, the women in my family, I mean, my great grandmother's like 99. My grandmother's 70. Wow. Like the women in my family live forever. So like my grandmother, she was one of the ones that really, she, you know, she's diabetic and she's 70 and she can't really walk on her own anymore and she can't take care of herself and, you know, like all this stuff. And I'm like, I don't want to be 70 and not be able to take care of myself. Yeah. I don't want to end up like them. And so that kind of started when I was 30. I quit smoking and started, you know, fad diets and just, you know, swinging wildly back and forth to not eating, eating all the things. And so that had been the what had been happening the 5 years before the diagnosis. And then when she told me I was pre-diabetic, I was just like, well, probably for about 6 months. And because this is how I do, I just wallowed in the overwhelming feelings.
Pretty diabetic now.
Yeah, it just, and so, it's just been a really long process of trying to get that together with the emotional eating and being willing to be uncomfortable. Like, I never realized how unwilling I was to just be uncomfortable, to just sit in like a feeling that I didn't necessarily like. Mm-hmm. And so I would eat so that I could distract myself. And so, and I would spend money. So, I mean, our financial situation is a bit of a wreck right now with credit cards and things like that, because it would be one, I would either be spending money or I'd be eating. And so when the diabetes thing happened, the money thing happened, you know, the spending money got worse. Not that the food got much better, but I could justify the money one more. And so I just started, I really started looking into, like, so I found Brené Brown, and I'm obsessed with her.
She's really third time. That's the third mention.
That's a third porn.
I'm really sorry.
Brown.
I can't help it.
She better tune into this podcast.
Oh, we should tag her.
Oh, yeah. You can do that.
Yeah.
And so through that, I found other, like, personal development books and stuff like that, and I just really started learning about how much my mindset and the way that I talk to myself really affected everything in my life. So I really started focusing on the way I talk to myself. And so I would go look in the mirror and be like, oh, God, look at your stomach. Look at this. Blah, it's so terrible. And so I stopped doing that. And when I would look in the mirror and that thought would come, I would make myself say something nice about myself. Even if it started out with just like, I really like my feet. My feet are very pretty. I'm very fond of them. I really like my feet. And that was the first the beginning of it. And, like, so it's about a year later, and, like, I look in the mirror now, and I'm like, there's some work that needs to be done, but I don't hate anything. Mm-hmm. And that's, like, huge. Mm-hmm. And so that rolled into, you know, me really paying attention how just how I'm talking to myself on a regular basis and how much I was letting myself live in negativity as far as, like, well, what if your best friend dies? Like, I would just come up with these crazy, and with my daughter especially, you know what I mean? Like, what if this happens with her and you, it'll be dead? And I would just, like, make myself crazy with all these what ifs that weren't even a possibility of happening. Or if they were, it was like a slim, you know, it was just ridiculous. And that was feeding my ability to comfort myself with food. I was, like, setting myself up for failure. And so I've really spent a lot of time working on my mindset. So this year, 2019, I started just trying to make small different changes with my food little by little. And so now it's, what is it, May? So I've been going to the gym for 3 months now.
Nice.
I'm down 30 pounds since October.
Nice.
And I really started getting serious. And yeah, so I'm just trying to make like small changes. I'm trying to be realistic and be easy on myself and not expect, it's taken me 12 years to get to where I am as far as my weight and my health goes. Mm-hmm. And so I can't expect it to be fixed in 6 months or a year. Like I need to, you know.
We didn't become addicted in one day.
Exactly. God, it's just like
easy does it.
I know, and that's the other thing too. I just applied the program. I just started applying the or tried to apply the program.
Easy does it.
Really it works for all of it.
All right. I'm gonna combine my last two.
You talked.
Did I steal one of yours?
No.
Okay. Go ahead.
No.
Good.
I'm long-winded. He's trying to.
Go ahead.
Scale me down.
Don't. You're judging eyes.
I'm always judging.
Son of a bitch. All right. So you talked about changing your perspective about step work. First four step was very fearful. Second one, you're like super excited about it. So how important is
and you, throughout this whole podcast, you talked about your mental mindset of how you approach things. So how important is it to go into that arena of step work with a positive mindset and be excited about it, and how much it changes that? And then at the very end of that, what is your favorite step?
So how important is it with my mindset with my first step? I think it is very important. I think I can definitely make it worse than it has to be.
Exactly.
With my mindset.
Yep.
So I am trying to, but I'm also, here's the other problem with me is I'm also very good at making things that are not good or whatever, making them pretty. Mm. So like I can take it to the other direction and be like, oh, you know, that whatever situation in childhood, it wasn't that bad, And so finding the balance for me can be hard, but I think it's also important for me to be able to, like feel whatever I'm feeling about it. So if I'm having a day where I am feeling super negative about it, that's okay, but don't feed the negativity. Mm-hmm. Don't help the negativity stay around longer. You know, make decisions that help me feel better. Like the thing with the gym, like it makes me feel better to go to the gym. Mm-hmm. 5 years ago, I stopped going because
just
it
don't
made
go
me
with
feel
that
better.
Chick anymore.
Right. Well, I'm actually going with her again. It's really funny. But I'm really, you know, trying to force myself to continue to do the things that make me feel better. Because when I'm having a negative day and living in negativity about whatever thing from my fourth step that has come up, it's very easy for me to just like lay on the couch and watch TV and wallow in that.
Yep.
And now I'm forcing myself, no, you're going to go take the dog for a walk. Or if all you do is go for a walk today, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to like spend an hour lifting weights at the gym.
Yeah.
You can just go for a walk some days.
Yeah.
And allowing where before I would, if I didn't burn 600 calories in the gym, then it wasn't good enough.
I'm a failure.
Yeah, I'm a failure. It's
yep.
horrible. So just really being nicer to myself. My last sponsor, God, I'm so grateful for her because she really taught me how to be nice to myself.
Mm-hmm.
Like you just have to be nice to yourself. Mm. And then my favorite step, it keeps changing. So for a long time it was two. Because the first time I ever wrote two, it was the first time I ever felt hope.
Yeah.
And was given hope. And mm-hmm. I just loved it. And that, but then when I got through some more, I would say now it's probably 11.
Nice.
It really just changed mm-hmm. my whole life and gave me tools, legitimate tools that I can use to help feel better.
Nice. Any more questions?
No.
No?
No.
I thought you had one more.
I do, but you know, time
I'm very
and everything.
Long-winded.
You know. Do you want me to ask it? Is that okay? Fine, David.
I feel cheated.
What?
I feel cheated.
No, it's recovery is not just in the rooms or however someone goes about recovery. It's also about, you know, going out and doing the things that we learn in the real world. So what ways do you bring the spiritual principles or the things that you learn into your day-to-day life with regular people, not with recovery people, but like when you go to work, how do you practice spiritual principles instead of acting on defects?
I immediately regret my decision because that's an amazing fucking question. Damn it.
Yeah, that's a great question. And
damn it.
It's like the area that I have, it would be work, would be the area where that has come up the most.
Oh, yeah.
And when, so before I got the job that I'm at now, I worked in jobs that I just hated. So I was just miserable and like practicing spiritual principles just wasn't even a thought because I just hated being there. And so when I got the job that I have now, I love going to work and everything. You know, it really gave me the opportunity to take a look at my behavior at work and how I am at work. And I can be very self-centered and arrogant at work and very, entitled, you know. And so I'm the first one there in the morning. And, like, if something isn't done, I would take it as a personal attack. Like, I get there and, like, the trash wasn't emptied. And I'm like, oh, how dare they not empty my trash? They hate, you know, I took it as a personal attack. Like, the world revolved around me. I really just had no idea how much I acted like the world revolved around me. And so I started, because I wasn't caught up in all the hatred of what I was doing, I was able to, like, start to see myself at work and how I really was and how difficult I could probably be to work with sometimes. And I've really had an opportunity to, like, take a look at that stuff and try to get better. And, you know, so now when I go to work, if something's not done, I just do it. And I'm just like, hey, we all have bad days sometimes. Mm-hmm. It happens. And I don't really feel that, but I tell that to myself. So hopefully one day I really will feel that way, you know. And, like, and, you know, I really can be very lazy sometimes. And I, you know, want other people to do stuff, and I get all, you know, just, I don't, indignant or whatever it is. And so I've really been working on, I read this thing that said that having patience can be looked at being generous with your time. And I really want to be a generous person. So it's really allowed me to start to change my perspective and be like, you know, I can do this thing that wasn't done because that's a generous thing to do. And I want to be a generous person, instead of taking it as like, oh, they purposefully didn't do that because they want to make my morning harder. And when in reality, they weren't thinking about me at all when they didn't do, when they forgot. And, you know, and how many times do I forget to do things? That's the other thing that I love to leave out.
Oh, yeah, because, like, we love to point the finger.
Yeah, how many times have I left something undone or half done, or because I was being lazy and, like, didn't feel like it or whatever.
And then when somebody else points it out to us, we're like, oh,
so offended.
How dare you?
Right, yeah.
We're talking about you right now.
Well, and it's so great, too, that I just didn't realize how much energy when I was at jobs before that I was spending being angry and hateful.
Oh, yeah.
When I got here, I had the extra energy to be able to be like, to really see myself and start to, like, grow and get better. So, yeah, I mean, without recovery, I never would have even thought about it. I mean, and so I worked at a restaurant when I was 18, and they made me a manager when I was 16. They made me a manager as soon as I was 18. Mm-hmm. So I just started out with this. Everybody would constantly tell me what good work ethic I had and how great an employee I was and blah, blah, blah. But through my addiction, that died. That went away. But when I got clean again, I acted like it didn't go away. Like I was still that 18-year-old hard worker when really I wasn't. I was this lazy whatever person that just wanted to do as little as possible, the bare minimum, just to get my paycheck and go home. And like, recovery's given me the awareness to be like, I can be that hard worker again. I just have to do the work.
Yeah.
Nice. Cool. All right.
All right.
I think we're about out of time. So we would like to thank our guest, Christy, for joining us today. Let's golf clap together.
Great job. Great job. See, I've become a part of the golf club.
I like it.
To make it better.
It sounds a little bit like...
It's a little kumbaya moment for all of us. I like it.
It's nice.
All right. Any quick statements for all the listeners out there who are struggling in recovery?
Quick statement, you know, just keep coming back. That's really the one that, like, if I've done nothing perfectly, but I literally just kept coming back. And eventually it started to stick and I started to grow and be different. And, you know, I'm super glad that I was willing to keep coming back even when I wasn't willing to do anything else.
Yeah, perfect. All right. Well, here at Podcast Recovery, we are aiming to expand the scope of support for recovering addicts. Accessibility and convenience of helpful services is paramount to combating addiction. We work to bring the message of recovery to every addict, wherever and whenever it is needed. We believe that a powerful voice of recovery should be obtainable, practical, and at the touch of a button. Every addict deserves to hear a message of hope, and Podcast Recovery is here to provide it. Follow us on Twitter, follow us on Facebook, invite your friends, check us out. Come join us. Come join us on the air, and we'll get your message out there. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Stay safe, stay clean.